I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today is our final episode of 2020. It's the Stacks Book Club conversation of Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine. We've brought back author, activist, and podcaster Darnell Moore to help us dissect this book of poetry, essays, and art. There are no spoilers on today's episode. And be sure to listen all the way to the end today to hear our pick for the Stacks Book Club January 2021 read. If you're looking for a way to support this podcast, consider joining the Stacks Pack on Patreon. That's a group of folks who contribute monthly and earn perks like our virtual book club, discounts on merch, and more. They make this show possible, and without them, there would be no The Stacks. If you love Citizen and want to discuss this book with a group of other book nerds, join the Stacks Pack by going to patreon.com/thestacks. This week, I'm shouting out some of our newest members of the Stacks Pack: Anne Marie Vorbach, Andrea Hall, Erica Wilhite, Carmen Martinez, Paula Munoz, Nikki Miller, Christina LeBeau, Alicia, Karen Kipper, and Madison. Thank you all so much. All right, now let's get to this conversation with Darnell Moore about Citizen by Claudia Rankine. All right, everybody, I am back again. It is December, the Stacks Book Club Day. I am joined by the wonderful Darnell Moore, and we are discussing Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine. Darnell, welcome back to the Stacks.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be back.
I'm really excited that you're here, and I'm really excited to talk about this book for a lot of reasons, which we can get into. But we always start with, what did you think of the book? And if you've read the book multiple times or anything like that, kind of give us a rundown of your intro relationship to the book.
For sure. So reading it again in 2020, 6 years after it first appears, right? I still ended up a bit jarred at the reading of it. Precisely because you realize that when this book came out in 2014, the world was at a different place within the context of the U.S., a different and similar place than we are now, right? So in 2014, the context is, I'm reading a book as someone who is paying attention to, working in the midst of, in community with organizers in the movement for Black Lives, right? In the heat of the Ferguson uprising, in the heat of the post, all those sort of reverberations of Trayvon Martin's murder, Renisha McBride, to me. I mean, I can go down the list.
Right.
So I'm reading this book at the time as someone who was attending to the world, attending to Black folks, the mattering of Black lives, in movement, work with people, writing in media about these things, lamenting about all of this. And then here I am in 2020 in the midst of a pandemic that is both a pandemic that is a result of COVID and then a pandemic that the president of the American Psychological Association calls a pandemic of racism.
Right.
Reading it again, and I'm just still amazed, haunted by, triggered by, just awakened that these words have taken shape and have made meaning yet again.
Mm.
In this moment. So I'm deeply moved by the book. Have some questions about who gets to be understood as among the Blacks, who do we imagine as being centered in our imaginations as those we ought to sort of reserve our care for? So I have some questions around the narrative,
right,
and who is in and gets left out. But yet and still, the thesis of the book is still very much haunting.
That's so interesting, because I know that a lot of some of your story has to do with the movement for Black Lives, which we can talk about more.
Sure.
Because I am interested in kind of the intersection of this work with the actual work out in the world and what that looks like. For me, I had a really different relationship with this book, and I almost feel silly saying this because having read it now, I'm confused what my issue was. But when I was given the book in 2017 as a birthday present from like some white girl that I was friends with that I'm not friends with anymore. She was like, "Oh, you're going to love it." And I was like, "Okay, I'll read it." I didn't pick it up.
And that's probably the first reaction.
Yeah,
like,
I was
you
like,
know, when
okay.
a white person gives you a book about like Black life.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I was like, and she is, but she's like, you know, woke. She's a public defender. She's like pretty active. So I wasn't totally put off by her, but I also was like, whatever, I'll get to it. And I picked it up three times between then and when we decided to do the book in November, and I never finished it. I could not get into it. For whatever reason, every time I picked it up, I was like, this is a book of poetry and I'm not into poetry. And I think I had this weird like shutdown, and I picked it up to read it with you and was like, okay, let's see, like, you're going to have to read it now. And I was instantly sucked in. I fucking loved it. I have no idea. Like, truly, I cannot figure out what the block was, because I found my bookmark on page 25, which is the furthest that I got into the book. And I remember where I was. I was giving blood at the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. And I remember sitting there like in the chair being like, oh, I'll be able to read this book while I give my blood. And I got to page 25 and started like reading apple juice labels or something. But this time I read it, I loved it. And then today before recording, I just listened to the audiobook and I loved it again. Like, so I don't know.
I think you hinted at it though. I think what you said was so telling that there is, it's interesting how the book has been praised as a nonfiction work, that nonfiction work in particular, right?
Right.
But it's poetry. Or even though some folk have sort of defined it as something that is sort of genre indeterminate, right? Like,
yeah,
it's sort of defined genre. But I think there is something about poetry that,
right,
that I don't know why, but for a larger public, it often is, and I'm speaking in generalizations here, and
yeah,
I could be totally wrong, but there's a way that folk are often afraid of poetry, are turned off by poetry, or don't see poetry as an open door, as an invitation in.
Right.
And I'm, even if like, I don't know that it does, regardless of the sort of type of poetry it is, there is a way that I often picked up poetry books like along the way. I was like, oh, this isn't for me. Or I can't,
yeah,
I don't have access into this sort of,
right,
world. But it's interesting that what happens is, to me, it felt like you sort of took you accepted that invitation in ways that I don't know if I've always have. Although I would say that a lot of the people that have taught me the most have been like Black queer poets, Black lesbian woman poets, Black gay poets, in spite of the ways that I may have been resistant to poetry sort of impact.
Yeah, I definitely think that the poetry part of it, I mean, we did a whole episode a few years ago with a poet about Intozake Shange's Wild Beauty. That was like a book club pick. And I mean, we talked a ton about like how poetry can be really difficult because there's, you know, a presumption that it's high art or that you're not going to get it. Like that your entry point, at least for me, is like, you've already failed when you start, you know, and it's like, okay, this is hard. And then maybe you'll do okay. And we talked a lot about that. And we also talked a lot about how with poetry, you know, one, if you like a third of the poems in a collection, that's an A+ collection, you know, that like poetry doesn't necessarily have to be, you don't have to like 100% of it the first time you read it or every time you read it, that poems can change and your relationship to them can change. And of course it makes sense when someone explains it to you and, you know, she teaches poetry and she is a poet. And so she was like making me feel good about being a Luddite or whatever, but I definitely still carry that with me when I approach poetry that I'm like, I'm already failing before I start. So I do think that that's part of the reason that I had a hard time getting into Citizen. Cause I even remember thinking when I first picked it up, I don't understand this. And then when I picked it up this time, I was like, what did I not understand? Like,
for sure.
I had clearly created something that this book wasn't. That being said, in the reading of it this time, I just thought it was incredible. I really felt seen and understood in ways that I hadn't felt in reading, especially in reading about quote unquote race or racism or, you know, violence against Black people. These ideas that people are all now reading about in the last 6 months.
Yes.
Usually they feel so directed towards the white audience. And this felt directed at some points towards a white audience, but I felt like she was saying on my behalf these things to white people, as opposed to like explaining something that I already knew to me and white people who don't get it, which is sort of a minor distinction, but to me felt like revolutionary in the reading, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you said that you had questions about. I'm super curious about who gets to be seen and understood, because because in the book she uses the word you a lot.
Yeah.
She just,
and I.
Yeah, you and I. And that's literally the next thing I have on my outline is the use of you and I in the writing and feeling seen and unseen. And I'm curious about your thoughts, and then I have other thoughts.
You know, in general, if it, so this, you know, the book, it is a lyric. It's an American lyric, right? It is a provocation of emotion, and it is, which is what sort of lyrical poetry is intended to do. Often from the sort of standpoint of the person who is a lyricist, right? Like here's a person that is giving us their feels. Trying to and doing a good job at inviting us into the worlds, the interior lives of the Black person, the Black character in the, that shows up in the poem, this sort of, the voice that's speaking, even giving us an invitation to figure out if that voice is the Black voice or not, right? Like there's all of this. But what I'm always thinking about when it comes to sort of the litanies of anti-Black violence, you know, there's ways that, of course, men, I'm one, cis men, Black cis men, straight men particularly, I'm not, are often centered as the site of violence, as a site also of inspiration, as the site of our investigation, as a site of our love. And I read the whole thing looking for the trans sister, looking for the trans body, looking for, and they may very well be there.
Right.
But not in the same way in which, you know, a name like Mike Brown, when it's evoked, it's very clear about what we are offering and let me be clear what I'm saying. I am not saying it is not, we can't invoke those names.
Right.
But in the litany of names, I don't hear the names of trans women who might be killed by a type of violence happening at the same time, or trans people who might be killed by police. I don't hear, you know, are kept the echoes of I'm looking at a book called American Hate, interestingly enough, and that American hate can look like anti-Black violence that is coming from vigilantes and the police, but it can also look like our queer folk being deadened. Some of the Blacks are queer and trans too. So I read the book thinking about how when Black life, when Black movements, when anti-Black racism, when police violence, when law enforcement violence, when when these things show up in literature, how often it is a case, it's organized around the lives of straight folk, mostly men. Mm-hmm. And there's even one page where it's a list that begins to disappear on a page, which is sort of remarkable.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Page 134, and I looked at the lists wanting to look to find the names. So there are women there, thank God, because we typically don't even see Black women who show up in these lists of the Black dead who have been taken from us. So we do see Black women, but I wonder, like, if you're hearing me, let me explain what this list looks like. It says in memory of, and it lists a bunch of names, and the font color begins to lighten as you get down to the bottom, such that the names become invisible. I read queer and trans lives in the invisibility.
Mm.
And often is the case that I want those names to show up as the Black lives too, that are taken, that are also subsumed under anti-Black racism in the US context, and targeted.
Right.
And targeted. So that was one of the questions that came to mind as I read
them. Yeah. I mean, just a little note on this page on 134. So as I said, I listened to the audiobook today, I mean, like an hour ago. And when the reader reads through this list, they only read the first four or five names and then just start going straight to in memory of, in memory of, in memory of. So when I listened, I thought, it's so interesting because I'm shocked that there's no women on this list, let alone no queer or trans. But just in the reading of it, there was an erasure. And it's not, I mean, it's missing. And so now it's making me want to reread the book and see what was changed again from the reading and the listening. But I hear what you're saying. And I think that it's right to question who we leave out when we tell the story of quote unquote Blackness or Black experience or Black violence.
And especially the subtitle is an American lyric.
Right.
So let's run with that. Right. Like in this sort of lyric, in this song about sort of the citizen, about the Black subject, the Black person living within the context of the U.S., who gets to play that role in our imaginations? Who do we tend to center? We know as it relates to sort of movement history that we've been socialized to believe that, say, civil rights movement, Black power movement, movements in between, the various iterations of movements that happened before that have all been organized by Black cisgender straight men.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. We know that's not true.
Right. Right.
So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, it's a question that I see as a loving critique, or at least maybe the answer is present in the invisibility. Maybe in that when we're hearing, you know, those four names, maybe that is actually a really prescient way. I'm assuming, I'm going to offer a positive reading here.
Sure.
Of the person saying, like, oh, there are people that we also invisibilize in this narrative of both Black progress and anti-Black violence that we also attempt to. That's an alternative way of reading it, right?
Right, right.
And that's sort of what I did. But I'm questioning again, you know, the cover of the book, which we're probably going to talk about, is there's a cover by David Hammer, whose work is sort of a sculpture from early 90s, right? I think it's like 93. And I imagine that, you know, there's this hood on the front if you all don't have the book, and it's a sort of white background, and it's, I'm assuming it's sort of a black or dark gray hood. There is no face, right? You just see the hood that is sort of disembodied, and that hood can represent a lot of things. It's representing sort of the haunting nature of the specter of lynching, the sort of deadly hand of anti-Black riot violence, and how it can disappear bodies, right, from this plane, from this earth, from people's families, and rip you apart. I mean, we get it. And as I read that, as a black queer person who's living under the same white supremacist capital heteropatriarchy that everybody else living under, mm-hmm. I'm also looking at that and going, I know that some of my folks, some of my elders could very well be, embodied in that hood. Mm-hmm. And some of them were queer. Some of them were taken from us because of HIV. Some of them were taken from us because of the sort of violence of the theological violent sort of ideas that they were led to believe they had to appeal to. And if they didn't, couldn't, you know, be seen as worthy, and they took their life. So for me, I guess my reading of it is I'm rereading into the book, The Invisibilized. Mm. Now, what I ask of the author is, you know, how might we better bring to the surface ghosts, those right. bodies that are often left out of this conversation?
Right. And also, no one should have to read The Invisible, because if that's not something that you're thinking about, then those people are left invisible. Like that's mm-hmm. something that's on the front of your mind and the top of your mind because of the work that you are and because the person that you are, and that those are, you know, that some of the people that are missing or invisibilized in this book intersect with some of your identities and with the work that you do, like the Being Seen podcast. I mean, I think that that's very clear. You're very clearly saying, let's not be invisible. Let's be mm-hmm. seen. Right. So that's something that's the work that you're doing when you read this. But for a lot of people, the work that you're doing has been rendered invisibilized until someone like you comes along. So, you know, I hear what you're saying, like in your generous reading of it, I hear that you're saying, like, I'm trying to find and create space for certain groups of people who have been pushed to the margins. But I also feel like, you know, the flip of that is like, that's not really fair either, because we all know that Black trans women are being murdered at a rate that is, you know,
yes,
double of what, you know, Blacks is, you know, whatever it is. I don't know yeah. the actual rate, but I think like your generous reading is generous for sure. And I love that that's how your brain works. And then the part of me is also like, yeah, but we should just, if you want us to see an American lyric, then it should include all types of Americans, all types of Black Americans. And, you know, I also in 2014,
yes.
I don't feel like, at least I don't remember, and probably a lot of it has to do with my own, where I was in my own place, but I don't remember Black trans folks being invoked really very much at all in the conversation, if not just a teeny tiny, tiny bit in the bigger public, you know, like, I feel like it was like being whispered about, but maybe not like.
And I want to be, I do believe in critical generosity. I want to also state too that, I'm reading into this an assumption. I can't assume that everybody say on that list identifies as straight.
Right.
I don't know their life worlds. I'm just talking about, you know,
right.
in ways that people self-identify.
And not just Claudia Rankine, but also sort of the bigger conversation.
Yeah. The bigger conversation, I don't want to even assume that the characters that are represented in the book, right? Like the particular subjects that right. I speak and the voices that I speak in are all straight. I just don't want to, that's right. also an assumption that can be read
of
into
course.
It.
Of course.
But like I, and yet with that, there is such a profound way in which this book that I probably didn't even, and like you, had a deeper appreciation for it in my reading now, though I was stunned and sort of captivated in the first time. Like it is such a wild display in the best way possible of private public emotion.
Yeah.
Of like, it's sort of like just on this, it's on the page. It's like, we are invited into sort of a blues experience. We are invited into, you know, and in some ways this sort of jazz experience where there is this improvisational, not only is the sort of text in terms of how it's organized improvisational, but the movement between emotions and what the person and what the audience is being, what you're feeling. I was reading, because you know I'm a nerd, so like mm-hmm. I like to, you know, I believe like critically reading a text is to sort of see what is. I had a teacher, Mark Taylor, who said, you know, when you're reading a text or is, you know, you're looking to critique a text, you have to look at what is in the text, that is sort of what is written, what's behind the text, that is what the social world is, the cultural world, the landscape of the world is, and what's in front of it, that is the reader and what context you bring to it. And anyway, with that said, so like I'm reading this, I went back to it, I was like, I've got to talk to Tracy about Citizen. Let me see what's happening. So, you know, we have this context. It's a book that comes into being in 2014. We know what's happening sort of in Black life, the right. emergence of Black Lives Matter. We have a Black president. We have this sort of litany of Black folk being killed, some of those Black folk were women. Some of those Black folk were trans. So we have that. And then we're rereading it as sort of emergence of the world. But the interesting thing in form, I went back and started looking at reviews and Evie Shockley, who I love and adore and have a deep respect for, was part of a symposium with like Roderick Ferdinand and some others in the LA Review of Books. And when mentioning one of the poets who sort of had a take on the book, Ruth Allen Kosher, she said it sort of book has like a genre indeterminacy. And I love that because, you know, this goes back to your point. Well, is it poetry? Is it not right. poetry? Is this right. narrative? Like, what the fuck do we read? Like, what right. we read? And I'm kind of like, so in so many ways, the form of the book is queer. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what I mean? So yeah. the form of the book is actually queer, which invites us as readers to think
right.
about the indeterminacy or at least the sort of, to make less rigid the ways, not only we think about, you know, the ways we think about genre, which is what you and I talked about, poetry, not poetry, but also the ways we think about Black life. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The ways we think about Black life. Right. Anyway, I could go on. This is, you got yeah. me nerding out right now.
No, I love it. Wait, okay. I do want to ask you about the use of the you and the sure. I, because especially in the beginning of the book, it kind of starts with these little, I don't know, vignettes or anecdotes from her or your life. In my reading, I assumed that you was Claudia Rankine, right? Like that she was telling stories sure. from her experience. So mm-hmm. whether it was the person saying, oh yeah, my son didn't get into that really fancy school because of affirmative action, or the cashier asking the you if they thought their card was going to work, or whatever those little you moments were. But the other part of me was like, oh, she's talking about things that have happened to me specifically because I've experienced these things yes. as a Black person. But then that led me to wonder, what does the you do to the white reader?
Ah, that's so good. It's so good because, you know, in a lot of my readings, I would read it as if the voice was the author's voice.
Right.
But you're also invited to play around with that because right. then I'm like, oh, that's me. Or that's, you know, that's such and such I work with who told me that fuck story about her boss.
Right.
You know, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of folk who've been writing about the you and the I. And if you talked about indeterminacy, how it sort of left open a bit. And that goes back to, I think, one of Claudia Rankine's central questions around, I was, you know, like there's a sort of way in which she responds to when she's asked about like, how do we come to know about race or how do we come to know about racism? That's the sort of like question mark that she has, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. And I think that's sort of playing into that. But in some ways I'm about to reach and read this quote from Jim Jordan because I have some pushbacks against that, which kind of connects with my, because I'm like, actually I do know, like this whole book
right.
is sort of a testament that Black people know about the workings of anti-Black racism yes. and actually about whiteness, even if white people don't know about whiteness, right?
Right. I mean, that's like the thing that I feel like I always say, and I don't know where I got it from, but Black people know more about white people than white people know about themselves.
I mean, you're very Baldwin here. Hold on one second. But I love this question. I like, what do you, like, so what happens if the white person finds himself in you? Which is why when you said a white person gave you the book, it almost makes you go, oh, like, did you read right. that? And you thought, yeah, it was like, you thought that shit was about you? You
right.
know, like,
right. Like, because it's like, it almost endears the white reader to, like, it's like, you know what it is? Okay. I think I'm finally going to have the opportunity to talk a little bit of shit about Hamilton because I sort of hate Hamilton for a lot of reasons. I was a theater major, so I have a lot of theater critiques about it. But one of the things that I really think that people never talked enough about with Hamilton is that what the show does is it allows the rich white audience who could afford to see the show, so before the or before it went on Disney or whatever, it allowed those people to relate to and to empathize with the bad slave owners and founders of racism in America because they were able to say, oh, immigrants, we get the job done. And we see these black and brown bodies. And so we know that we're good liberals because we like the show and we're listening to hip hop and it's super fun, as opposed to having them question, what does it mean to be rooting for Thomas Jefferson in this way? And so that's sort of what I feel like the U does in this book, possibly for white readers, where it lets you feel like, oh, I get it because it's me. It's my experience too. I get to wear this experience. And that, I don't know, cloaking of the white mind in the black experience, or like the using of black experience to kind of, I don't know, let white people off the hook in certain ways, always really makes me frustrated and like,
I love that. But you know, one of the things I did like as a device is that there is a way that, say I'm a white reader and I'm reading this. There's a way that I think Claudia Rankine cleverly invites that as it is actually making space for that. Right. And if I were a white reader, what you find in that most of these sort of passages are these points in the book, you find yourself at a point in which you begin, you have to ask a certain amount of questions because I may be like, you're reading it and you're like, oh shit, that's me. First paragraph, second paragraph. Damn, I fucks with this too. That's me. Third paragraph. Oh, but clearly this wasn't about me because that sentence says you almost assume, you assume she thinks she's thanking you for letting her cheat and feels better cheating from any, from an almost white person. Anyway, point is, I think at some points in these readings,
she checks the audience.
Yes, you get checked, fuck.
She does. I want to give her full credit for that because in Hamilton, they don't do that. And I don't want to compare these two things because I think that she's working on a level that is like 20 times above what Lynn is working through. Whatever. I know everybody loves Lynn. Cancel me. I don't care. But I think that the she pulls it off. I think she pulls off the thing where it's like you allow the white person to feel comfortable that they're like they're the good guy. And then all of a sudden she's like, yoink. And she rips that shit off and she's like, no. Like, you don't get to be safe in this experience. You don't get to wear this experience and feel like you now get it.
I just like, you know, it's harder for people to get this unless you like hear it. But there is this, I'm just going to pick something on page 7, a passage that's sitting across the page from a photo of a neighborhood. It's like the suburban street. And there's a sign on it, the sign, it's a street sign that reads Jim Crow Avenue. So this is Michael David Murphy's photo. And the name of the photo is called Jim Crow Road. It's a photo from his 2007 work, and it's in like Invoke in a neighborhood in Georgia. Anyway, so that's the image. And then you read. So say I'm a white person. Certain moments send adrenaline to the heart, dry out the tongue, and clog the lungs. Like thunder, they drown you in sound. No. Like lightning, they strike you across the larynx. Cough. After it happened, I was at a loss for words. Haven't you said this to yourself? Haven't you said this to a close friend? Early in your friendship, when distracted, would call you by the name of her black housekeeper. You assumed you two were the only black people in her life. Eventually she stopped doing this, though she never acknowledged her slippage, and you never called her on it. Why not? Not yet. And yet you don't forget. If this were a domestic tragedy, and it might well be, this would be your fatal flaw, your memory, vessel of your feelings. Do you feel hurt because it's the all black people look the same moment? Are because you are being confused with another after being so close to this to this other. Anyway, so like that's another moment where like even if I am reading gratuitously, right, and I'm reading myself and I'm like, oh shit, like, oh, I had this experience. She like checked your ass. Mm-hmm. Like, no, you didn't. Mm-mm. Or you may have had this experience, but not in this position.
Right. Or you may have had this experience and you still did the wrong thing. Like,
You may have been in this experience, but you weren't in it as a protagonist, right? Like you may have been.
Right.
And
right,
I love that. I do love that.
Yeah. I agree. We haven't even talked about the fact that there's a bunch of art in this book. There's a bunch of artwork throughout the book, which of course I did not get when I re-listened to it on the audiobook, and none of you are getting if you're listening to us talk about it. So you have to actually get the physical book. It's very rare that I'm like, you must get the physical book. You cannot do audio. But I mean, you can do audio, but it's lacking a huge part of the book. Just like this book is sort of poetry and maybe essay, it's also artwork. It's also visual artwork.
Yeah.
It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, we have to talk about the Serena Williams section. Because
yes,
the Serena Williams section, to me, is my favorite part of the book so far.
It's everything.
It's so good. And the thing that's wild, which of course, I mean, I guess this speaks to the whole book, is like she wrote this in 2014 and yet the shit is still the same, right? Like it's true for the part where she talks about, you know, the different black people who were murdered, right? Of course. But yes. It's also true for Serena Williams, who still somehow miraculously is playing tennis at such a high level and is still being cheated out of victories and is still being condemned and judged and talked down to about her displays of emotion. And I mean, so the first incident in the book is at the 2004 U.S. Open. And just anecdotally, I started dating my now husband in 2010 and I never watched tennis before, like a little bit, but not really. And so when I started watching tennis, I did not know the history of this Serena Williams stuff. And I have been watching more actively since 2010. And like now I don't ever miss when she plays and I actually really like tennis. But reading this, I did not know the history of her career and the 2004 and 2009 incidents where she was basically cheated out of wins. So when these things happened again more recently, I didn't know that history. And I was like, oh my God, this is so crazy that the same shit
almost 20 years later is still happening to her. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, basically she's had multiple instances where line judges or chair judges in tennis have called, it sounds like in 2004, pretty egregious calls against her that were not. And then she had a foot fault situation in 2009 against Kim Clijsters. And the book is talking about the anger or the rage in which to be a successful artist is sort of how it's presented. It's sort of presented with this idea that you have to tap into the rage. And what Claudia Rankine is talking about is the world becomes obsessed with the rage that's being projected as a performance and not with the thing that has caused the rage.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It makes my head kind of spin and also makes my stomach kind of hurt and sort of makes me feel sick, because I can't speak for you or any other Black person, but I have to assume that every Black person in America of a certain age has had an experience where you are reprimanded or belittled or called into question or whatever because of your quote unquote rage or emotion, but the thing that provoked it was not. And right? I can't speak for everybody, but I feel confident that I can on this one.
I want to say this, that this was one of the most moving aspects of this text for me. Mm-hmm. One, because of the overwhelming love present in this text from Claudia Rankine to Serena, from Black woman to Black woman. I mean, there's a question that she asks in the writing. What does a victorious or defeated Black woman's body in a historically white space look like? Mm. Yes, Black folk have had this experience where rage, right, becomes, you know, one, in the context of the U.S., we don't get to rage,
right.
You know, and because, you know, rage will make us, we are human persons, and even though that's denied, it had been denied, but we don't get to rage. I was recently doing a book reading with a group, reading Brittany Cooper's Eloquent Rage, and a question that I asked the group was, well, who gets to rage and why? Whose rage is seen as acceptable and why? Whose rage is policed, not just ideologically, but literally, who will we call the police on? Mm-hmm. If we, even if they assert any type of rational emotional feeling like anger or rage, etc. And in this case, you know, there's also a line where she pretty much says something like a Black woman being thrown to, I think, like a white background.
Yeah.
Like, so you have Serena Williams in the midst of this sort of like white streamed space, and who is policed, and yes, Black people experience this, but I want to be specific to why it was important that she centered on Serena Williams, because Black women, in the same way that Brittany Cooper's write about Eloquent Rage, in the same way that so many Black feminists before her have talked about the very particular ways that Black women are not only policed, but violated, our violence is enacted upon them because of this presumption of rage, is something that we have to talk about. I mean, who gets called the B word when they are asserting themselves? Mm-hmm. You know, who gets shut out of the public conversation if they're too loud? Mm-hmm. You know, we got Monique Morris, who doing work on little Black girls getting suspended in schools because they're showing up as like too fast or have too much mouth and are showing up statistically as being pushed out of schools and suspended in schools in ways that their male counterparts are not, whether white or Black. So that's a very particular way within the context of the U.S. context that Black girls and women, femme-identified peoples, rage, humanities are actually policed. Yep. That is just not the same for everybody else. And the last thing, you know, she makes mention of Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe by Horton Spillers, which is sort of a pivotal text by a Black feminist scholar whose work in that text was all about the ungendering of Black women in the American context,
right,
in the U.S. chattel slavery context. In other words, you know, to be Black woman, to be marked as a Black woman in this context, were to be seen as not even women. Mm-hmm. to be seen as ungendered, as a thing, to be sort of controlled.
Right.
And that, just that nod to that article in that work, was actually hinting to the fact of the project of sort of like Black women showing up in the context of the US as ungendered bodies, as things to be controlled, to be manipulated, and to be violated, like Sandra Bland, right? Like if you show up and speak back.
Right.
So that essay moved me. So I'm like, y'all, I'm going off because like I read that shit and I'm just like, every time I read it, mm-hmm. It just makes me so upset. And also it breaks my heart open so wide for Black girls, women, and femme folk. If you don't need another example of how patriarchy and misogyny is realized, misogyny noir, like as Moya Bentley would say, right? Realized in the lives of Black women and girls, read that essay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other part about it that I think is really just like, because personally, you know, I'm a woman, I'm a Black woman who loves sports. I am a really huge sports fan, and Serena Williams is one of the greatest athletes of our time, male, female,
period.
Human. She is one of the best, period. And one of the things that I think that is overlooked about her that hurts me, like makes me emotional, is her joy. She is so, I'm like crying. She's so, every time we see her anywhere, not on the court, and even on the court, when she walks out, when she comes out, when she seawalks at Wimbledon, whatever that is, right? With Beyonce, like with her daughter, and she's robbed of that part of herself publicly in a way that other athletes are not, you know, like even, you know, like people love to hate LeBron James, myself included as an athlete. I love LeBron as a person, but I hate LeBron as an athlete. But we get a sense of LeBron as a human, right? We understand when LeBron is mad versus when LeBron is happy. We get to see him as a father. We get to see his joy. He's doing the Space Jam thing. Like, he gets to be this full human. And he is as great an athlete, maybe not quite as great, as Serena Williams. And we don't ever get to see that part of her. She only is someone that we, unless you seek it out, right? Unless you're like, oh, I love Serena, let me follow her on Instagram. Like, unless she's writing that narrative. But even with the stuff with Serena, and she brings it up in the book about John McEnroe. If you're not a tennis person, which I wasn't, but now I understand it, John McEnroe is famous for being an angry asshole on and off the court. That is his personality. Right. Like, he is known for being that.
And his brand.
That's his whole brand. I mean, like, it was literally him and what's it, Borg. Anyways, those two guys, and they always went head to head. And he was like the showy, cocky, asshole, angry jerk. And his whole brand and all of his money and everything about him comes from that personality. And for him to critique Serena or for him to comment on Serena's emotion, knowing full damn well that if those types of things had happened to him, if he were in the situation that she had been put in time and time again, he would have done five times as much and it would have been applauded, you know? And like, I know that that's the story of America, and I know that's what it means to be a Black woman in America, and I know it on an intellectual level, but when you read it and you see it and someone says it to you and someone makes me have to face it, it's painful. Like, that is hard. It really makes my stomach hurt. I feel nauseous because it's like you're being forced to acknowledge something that you kind of would rather just not deal with because it's hard to deal with, right?
And that's precisely the book's aim.
Right, right.
It literally, what you just spoke about is an American lyric.
Right.
And in that lyric is the experience of Serena as a Black woman, you know, who is hit at all fronts within, you know, a white supremacist patriarchal culture. And that does not exclude the systems, the white people, the industry,
right?
That make those hits possible, right? So in some ways, going back to the earlier point, white people can find themselves in this book. They should, because there is no experience of anti-Black racism without the white person and the system of white supremacy making it possible. Right. So you are actually present in the book.
You might not like your part.
You know what I'm saying? And it's just like, and the reason that, you know, the thing about what I love about the book is the very way in which these sort of litanies that are laid out in the book are so mundane. They're so pedestrian and common. It's like, and if you read it as a Black person, you're like, oh shit. Like, this is like the not spectacular aggressions, right? It, you know, this is like the everyday shit that we breathe in like air. And there's a way that she lays that bare so, so powerfully that is what jars me. I mean, it's the little shit, like, you know, walking down the street, you're in a kid, you know, that really haunts me. A quote. Go for
I was just going to say, it's sort of like the Christian Cooper story, right? Like, it's like that one didn't end in the police coming and hurting him. And so, and so that story, it gets to be something different, right? But like, it's sort of like these little moments that we recognize as Black people that we've experienced. I don't know if you read Cast.
I've not gotten to it yet.
Okay. Well, I have a lot of thoughts about it, but some of them are good and some of them are not. But one of the things she does throughout the book is she presents some of her experiences, Isabel Wilkerson, as these like little stories throughout the book. And I think that Claudia Rankine does that in this book so much better.
Yes.
It's like what she tried to do in Cast and it didn't quite land for me, but it lands in this book. Like these little stories, like you're like, oh yeah, I've been there. Oh yeah. Uh-huh. Oh yeah. That too. And it's
almost like everyone.
Yeah. You're like, oh yeah, that one. You're like, oh, haven't had that one, but my brother had that one. Or like, you know, like it's like, it's just like a bingo card. Like, bingo, I got it. I've done all these. I do want to talk about Black Lives Matter and sort of the book is kind of broken into these sections, and you know, there's like kind of like the Serena section, there's like the early, like, I don't know, microaggression or like daily
seven
aggression section. Yeah. And then there's this section that's sort of, it's not all, it's
scripts.
Yeah. They're like these little like scripts, and one's about Katrina, one's about Trayvon Martin, one's about the Jenna Sit. I don't know. I don't really have a question. I feel like that part, what she does there, at least for me, and what she does throughout the book, is that she draws really clear lines between all of these sections, basically saying that all of this is connected. Like your little microaggression that you experienced or you perpetrated against me, depending on who the reader is connected to the murder of Trayvon Martin, is connected to Zidane Zidane's headbutt, is connected to Hurricane Katrina. And I don't think it's done as well as she does it here often. I don't think it's as clear.
That's such I love what you just named. I actually hadn't even thought about that. Because there are seven sections of the book that are not delineated in that way. I think that that's right, that you're reading, are journeying through a connection between the everyday mundane ways in which we live our lives as folk within the U.S. context, whether you're Black or white or otherwise, in the context of sort of like anti-Black racism, right? And these, what we might call microaggressions, and how they feed or exacerbate or our response to consequence of systemic inequity. You know, Hurricane Katrina, natural disaster exacerbated by systemic inequity. You know what I mean? Trayvon Martin, may he rest in peace, taken and snatched from his family, from his community, undergirded by systemic inequity that is present within our criminal injustice system that allows for someone like Zimmerman to be set free, right? And we can go down the line with how what we might understand to be sort of like non-spectacular violences of telling a Black person that they might be, I don't know, let's say articulate, because they're able to sort of speak in a certain way that registers with someone, how that is somehow not connected to Zimmerman being upheld in the public imagination as someone worthy of millions of dollars, that people raised to get him legal support. Right. Like, those things are deeply connected.
Right.
And I love that what she asked the reader to do, rather than give us the explanation, demand that the reader make good on what she, I think, has a faith in the reader to believe and or at least understand to be true. Like, there's no way we can walk around here and act as if we don't know how this shit works, how racism works itself out on behalf of white people and against everybody else. Like, I think she's asking or at least giving space for the reader to do that exploration on their own terms, to find themselves in the text, to unravel their fucking selves, to reckon with themselves. And, you know, in ways that, like, I think that this could have been done disingenuously, where, you know, like, there's this sort of like work to be done where you're writing towards with the white gaze in mind. I didn't get that. I didn't read like there was this sort of like this very generous reading for white folks to find their way in it. I felt like, in ways that Claudia Rankine may even say she may not know, mm-hmm. or question mark when it comes, I actually feel like she does.
Right.
And she gets it, and she gets the Black experience. And white people are expected to show up in this reading to figure themselves out. And I just want to read this quote from, you know, when you interviewed me before, I mentioned Civil Wars by June Jordan. And in this one essay that she wrote in 1969, it's called Black Studies, Bringing Back the Person. There's this one quote that I loved, and it made me think about this book. It is not that we believe only Black people can understand the Black experience. It is rather that we acknowledge the difference between reality and criticism as the difference between the host and the parasite. As Frantz Fanon has written, the colonized man does not say he knows the truth. He is the truth. Mm-hmm. Likewise, we do not say we know the truth. We are the truth. We are the living Black experience, and therefore we are the primary sources of information. I'm like, if that's not what this book is about.
Right. Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm like, that's it.
Right. Damn.
Ain't that some shit? Mm-hmm.
I'm like trying to think. I don't know where we go. I mean, that's just so spot on. Ugh. Okay. I'm going to ask you this because I think that you're smart, and I think that you might have an answer for me that I will think is acceptable. I think about this question all the time, and sometimes people give me shit for talking about this, but I think it's important and I don't care. So if you have a problem with me asking this question, don't DM me about it. Please get out of my DMs. Like, truly, my DMs are a dumpster fire. Anyways. One of the things that I'm always curious about as a Black woman who creates, and you are a Black man who creates lots of things, is how can we create away from the white gaze? G-A-Z-E. Mm-hmm. Can we, or do we have to create with the white gaze and find ways to subvert it because the whiteness is the dominantness in our culture as of now?
Listen, I don't know why people would be even DMing you around that.
People get mad at me because they think...
I don't know what. Tell them to go read some Toni Morrison.
Well, that's why they get mad at me. They say people, like, you wouldn't ask a white person this question. I'm like, yeah, because a white person wouldn't know the answer to this question.
No, but I think what I hear in the asking is a generous question. That is, as Black creatives, how do we do the work of resisting the white gaze?
Yes.
I think that that's a question that we, you know, I don't think it's about, like, you know, how, why would you not ask? No, I think it's right on. And for me, like, when I wrote my book, and this is as basic as possible, I had in my imagination, I would literally imagine that I was standing at the back of a theater. The theater was dark. There was a big screen. There are probably, I don't know, maybe several roles. And in the middle of the theater, there was a little boy, that's from what I can assess, a young child who I'm gendering as a boy because he was sort of like imagining him to be me, whose back was toward me. And all that I ever saw was like this little Black boy with this little knotty head like mine. And I would look at him and fix my gaze on him. as I wrote. Mm-hmm. And even every time, like if I had any shift in my imagination, I would center and fix my imagination back on him. And that is who I wrote to. Mm. And that was a practical way for me to because I've realized that I'm writing a book about a very particular sort of life in an industry that's dominated by white people, the publishing industry, that will have editors. My editor, I had a really good editor. Katie O'Donnell, love her, white woman who respected my gaze, who didn't demand that I sort of turn this very specific story into a universal one or create avenues for, say, the white person to find themselves on a page. Now, the reason why it's important to ask the question is because I think in this moment when editors within media, newspapers, publishing houses are asking Black writers to expand the sort of parameters of their imagination because the audience is so much wider than just the people that live in Camden where you're from, Darnell. Mm-hmm. We have to be ready to come up with strategies to push back against that. So when it came down to the review, the legal review of the book to make sure I'm going to get sued by people and shit, and the white woman from Texas, who I assumed was also straight, says to me, oh my God, I read your book and I related to so many parts, and I go back to her, how? Because I didn't write it for you. And I laughed. I'm like, I'm not even being smart, but like, I'm amazed that you found yourself in it. And she said, I did. Reminded me about the power of singularity. Mm-hmm. You can find yourself as a human person in a story that is singular because there's humanity in it. This is why something like Moonlight did so well. It was about a very specific neighborhood in Miami. You ain't had to be from there, but somehow there was something about love and connection and intimacy that you still felt, even if you were not Black, even if you were not queer, even if you were not from that area, in ways that Black people don't always get allowed to sort of do when we're in a space demanding of us to do what they don't demand of white people to do. You're not asking white people to think about people in Camden when they're writing their stories. Right. So we do have to ask this question of ourselves as creatives. So the way that I say to that is be very vigilant about who we center in our imaginations as the audience and fight like hell to ensure that we can keep our gaze locked on them.
Right. Do you ever struggle with that? Or do you find that it comes easily?
I know my audience. You know, I don't struggle now. Right. I think that I've put this into practice for some years now. You know, like, I don't care, like, what... you know, it doesn't really matter where I write for now. It's just like, I don't care what the outlet is. This is who I'm writing to. Mm-hmm. And you can accept that or not. Even if it's like a media outlet I'm writing to where there's sort of a wide white audience, I still am very thoughtful about not writing to overwhelmingly do the work to appeal to that voice. Mm-hmm. And I'm very conscious of it. And one has to be conscious of it in order to sort of push back against it.
Right. Okay. We're almost out of time, basically. I mean, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on or talk about before we wrap up, I should say?
No, I think this was good. This was like, first of all, I love every opportunity where I can like really talk about books in this way. You can see I nerd out quickly.
Same. I created a whole podcast to do this. This is my happy place.
No, I love this, and I appreciate you for creating space to love on these books like this. Especially, I get to do that on a book that's the book of a Black woman. So,
well, thank you. I'm gonna just there's one thing that I think I stuck out. I'm gonna keep saying this is the one thing that stuck out to me. But one of the things that stuck out to me is this quote on page 135, which is right after that list of names that we talked about earlier, where it says, "Because white men can't police their imagination, Black people are dying." And I think that quote just, I mean, from day one, from moment one in America, that is the I mean, like, that's the truth of this country. Like, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, maybe. But because white men can't police their imagination, Black people are dying 1,000%.
And to also offer to that, right after that quote, about 75% of that page then is all white. It's no more words on it. The next page is blank. Mm-hmm. So when Tracy's talking about you have to actually pick up the book, that is such a strong indictment mm-hmm. of the consequence of white men not policing their imagination. The consequence of them not policing their imagination is invisibility, is death.
Right.
It's gone.
Right.
And you sit here and have to look at these blank two pages after and just like, damn.
Right. Well, okay. That's the last thing I'm going to say. It just clicked to me because you, when we were talking about the white gaze and being black creative and creating, one of the things you said was about, you know, focusing and expanding your imagination, you know, for our black selves, our black imaginations. And I think it's interesting that to create as a black person, there is sort of this like leaning in to this imagination and to like trusting this imagination mm-hmm. versus the opposite, which she's saying is white men need to start policing their imagination, that like mm-hmm. the recklessness of the white male imagination is death, whereas the freedom of the black imagination is life or creation. I just think that's sort of an interesting thing to think about.
It is.
I guess we'll leave it there.
Yes.
Everyone, this is Darnell Moore. Please check out his book. We didn't even really do a full plug on the book, but we should. It's called No Ashes in the Fire. It's incredible. We talked about it a bunch last time he was here. So please go back and listen if you haven't. Darnell, thank you so, so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for this. This did my heart good. I appreciate you and love the stacks. Keep it up.
Thank you. And everybody else, we will see you in the stack. Thank you all for listening, and thank you to Darnell Moore for being our guest. The Stacks Book Club pick for January 2021 is The Office of Historical Corrections by Danielle Evans. We will be discussing this book on Wednesday, January 27th, and you can tune in next week to find out who our guest is. Please make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts, and if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirages. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.